This podcast is brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine for those that love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew. For a third of our mini series of Las Vegas brewery podcasts, we're down on the south side of town in Henderson, Nevada. And joining me for this episode is Cameron Fisher, head brewer for Craft House. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Really excited to be on the show.
I appreciate you making time. This is a real quick, one night trip, turn around, grab a bunch of podcasts. And as soon as we finish this, I'm going to rush back to the airport and get back to Colorado. But when I was here last fall and for the American Distillers Institute conference, popped by the tap room that you all have in the arts district, drank some good beers. And then, of course, when I was out at Marble earlier this year, I got your contact information out of Josh Trujillo because you guys have just done a collaboration. And of course, that's how this all came into being. The Craft House has been making some great beers. My experience at that tap room was an excellent range of beers, everything from lager beers to hop forward beers. It seems like guys are doing some creative work across the spectrum there. And I think through this episode, we're going to start by talking about cold IPA, because right now you've got we're drinking a cold IPA that you brewed for CBC, just to keep the teas out there for everybody. This one was something with Crosby. And we'll get into some of the details around that too, using advanced hop products as well as some classic hops in all their formats. And, an interesting approach both to grist and to hopping on that one. Going to dive in and, get a better understanding about how you brew that. And then, we'll see where the conversation goes from there, because you guys are brewing interesting beers across this entire spectrum. We're going to talk more about that first at G&D Chillers. They always strive to build great chillers. Partner with them as you build great beer. But don't just take it from me.
Hey, this is Josh Erickson of Jafuncta Brewing in Mandeville, Louisiana. The team at G&D were a critical part of our 10X expansion, always just a phone call or email away. And thanks to their superior equipment, technology, and documentation, commissioning our new chiller was smooth and straightforward. Now we can't wait until we need to upgrade our existing chiller.
That's right. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring of your new G&D chiller. And ProBrew is changing the game at this year's CBC in Las Vegas. As part of ProMoc Craft Beer Solutions, they're presenting a holistic approach to craft brewing operations. Through their display of animations, holograms, and machinery, they'll be highlighting how they can advance every aspect of your production line. Visit go.probrew.com/CBC24 or contact them at contactus@probrew.com to schedule one-on-one time with one of their subject matter experts at booth 1783 at this year's show. ProBrew. Brew your beer. Also, you might have heard of Old Orchard, but have you heard of their newest flavors? Berry Blend, Blood Orange, Lemonade, and Tart Cherry are the latest additions to their lineup of flavored craft juice concentrate blends. Old Orchard's R&D team can also formulate custom blends unique to your needs. To learn more and request your free samples, head on over to oldorchard.com/brewer. All right, Cameron, we normally start with a little bit of history. What's yours? Tell us your personal history, your entree into brewing and craft beer, and then a little bit about the Craft House story.
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep it a little short because I could make the story very long. But I was going to school in Vegas at UNLV and discovered beer through the beverage management program there and started homebrewing at an undisclosed age by somebody local who I have no idea where he disappeared to. But anyway, that was 2009 during the recession, and there was no jobs here after college. So I moved back to Colorado and continued my homebrewing adventures there, buying stuff from the Brew Hut, from Ashley and Bill, who were there at the time. And I ended up winning one of their homebrew competitions, and then I got to brew on the little small system there with Bill at Dry Dock. And, I was like, you know what? This is a lot better than corporate finance. I'm going to open my own brewery. And then, that didn't happen because I saw how stressful that was for many, many people. And I didn't really know what I was doing. That would have been a huge mistake. So a few years down the road, I ended up having the opportunity to quit my day job and get a job at a brewery. So I kind of helped work at Destige, which is no longer in existence. And then Odyssey Beer Works was opening. One of the original owners there, Josh, he's no longer there, but he started Twin Monkeys Canning.
Sure.
And so him and I were basically brewing off the bat starting that summer that they opened. And I was there for a couple of years before my wife said, we're moving to Oregon. About a year later, moved back to Colorado, and Odyssey was like, hey, can you come back? Because that would be cool. And so I did. And we, after that point, I believe we won the GABF for our barrel aged. And that was really cool. Had fun to be on stage for the first time and met a lot of cool people. Then Dana, he's, at that point, he works for Burke Oak. He was the president of the NBAA in Denver at the time. And super good dude. He came in to drink all the time. And we worked on a bunch of SOPs for all their chemicals. So he'd give us all these experimental chemicals and like, try this regimen, try that. And it was cool to kind of come up with some stuff that like everybody across the industry is using now, kind of based off of me having to clean the tank 5 or 6 times. So you're all welcome. But
we all appreciate you.
Shortly after, maybe a year later, we had Collab Fest. We were doing something with River North and find out the next day that my wife's pregnant. So we decided that she is an engineer, so it made more sense for me to be at home. She just really likes IPAs, so it worked out. But it made more sense for me to be at home with my son. So I ended up quitting a couple months down the road and just stayed home with the baby for a while. Then got really bored. Just can't go from being on your feet all day to sitting down like
sure,
that.
Sure.
It's not going to work. And we talked about coming back to Las Vegas. She grew up here, and a couple months down the road, I saw that Craft House was hiring, and we interviewed and we talked about UNLV. They're owned by 2 alumni as well. They really had some lofty goals for what they wanted to achieve, and thought it was really on par with kind of what I foresaw myself doing. So she told me to apply, and well, here I am 6 years later. So
here you are. Here you are. Yeah. So, you know, Craft House had been, you know, had been going when you joined. But also, you know, now as head brewer, there's a, you know, a big piece of what you do is, you know, designing and creating new beers, and the beers that you're making now have certainly built on the reputation they had before and, you know, helped grow that. Talk to me about that creative process. You know, there, because you're brewing a lot there, you have a number of core beers. There are some expectations around those, but you also have plenty of room to play.
Yeah. I mean, really it all kind of started from, I know, cause it sounds kind of lame, but the Odyssey message when I was brewing there was, you know, everybody's on their own kind of palate journey, if you will. And including me myself, like, so I'm not always wanting to brew the same things or what's popular or hype. I really want to challenge myself a lot of the time. And challenge kind of the palates of people that are coming in the door. Maybe a little too much when I first got here, because the market here is not quite maybe as forward-thinking as, say, Denver or Oregon was. So I've had to kind of pull it back a little bit. But you know, we've kind of thrown everything out the window to see what sticks with the consumer here. And there's ideas that I've just done over and over again to kind of perfect how they are. Like we have a vanilla coffee cream ale, just light summertime traditional cream ale, but you know, we've got the vanilla and the coffee aspect, so it just looks light, drinks like coffee. Now that's one of those weird adjunct beers that even I enjoy because I love coffee beer. Creative process, so usually we start with an idea and typically comes from like food. And so like, I don't know, one morning it's, man, avocado toast, I wonder if I could make a beer out of that. So I did.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, we just did like an imperial amber ale multi-grain kind of approach with avocado blossom honey and cracked black Tilechery peppercorns, and took home 2 medals in the honey beer competition from that. So you never know, like you can get inspiration from anywhere, but I think that always starts with what you want the final product to taste like. And if you don't work backwards, you're usually in for a bad time.
Interesting. So, you know, is there some sort of guidelines that you use at Craft House, you know, to steer where you go in the beer, or, you know, is that kind of adventure and experience, you know, the kind of defining piece of it all?
Well, there's a little bit of that exploration, but I think we're all in the business of staying in business.
Sure,
as
sure.
As another famous brewer once told our owners. So if you can't sell that beer, then you probably shouldn't be making it. And that's a weird like pill to swallow for a lot of people that just want to be creative. But if there's not a plan to sell that product or there's not a market for that, then unfortunately, I don't get to play in that realm too much anymore with kind of those wild one-off ones like that.
I look at it. It's the difference between design and art. You know, art is something you make for, you know, no one but yourself. Design, you know, you come with a set of parameters that you need to work within, you know, whether you're, you know, making something, you know, specifically to appeal to an audience of some sort. And like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's possible to be very creative and also set those kinds of, you know, parameters and boundaries for yourself. What I find interesting is that you do this not just within the like flavorful realm of adding more ingredients, but you know, you also are going the other direction and trying to, you know, and saying brewing a, you know, Czech inspired kind of Keller beer and you know, Czech dark lager, like, you know, the lager piece is also there in addition to, you know, some of the more flavor forward stuff.
Yeah, it's been a good transition, I think, for just the consumer base, even in our tap rooms over the last 5 years. I mean, we've seen people reaching out and exploring more with new and new styles and finding what they really like. And so I think when we started brewing our Czech Keller pills, if you will, like 5 years ago, you know, people are like, what is that? And then now it's like our number one selling beer in the tap room. But that didn't happen overnight, you know, and maybe in some cities it would, but it just didn't seem to be the case here. People just wanted micheladas, blonde ale, sour beer, you know, West Coast IPAs. They still want those, of course. So we haven't, you know, stopped doing that. But then there's the consumer that's, where's your milkshake IPA? But I feel like that small consumer base that's looking for that happens to be the loudest also. They're like, well, every time they come in, they got to remind me that I don't have my milkshake IPA on. Well, that's only once a year you get that. Sorry. I don't want to brew that because it's a huge pain in my butt.
It's interesting the way that you say it though, because, and I think that's right. You know, you need to make beer that'll sell, but oftentimes, especially when it's something new, but not obvious new, you know, like a Czech style Keller pills, you know, it's the repetition and the familiarity that makes people comfortable with it. And then of course, like, you know, within a taproom environment, when you see it being poured, it naturally sparks interest from other folks that might not have found it. You know, they don't understand what it might mean on a menu, but when you see, you know, that lucre pour and you see that foam in that mug, and then, you know, it becomes an attractive thing in the same way that when you, you know, smell one of those milkshake IPAs, like, oh, okay, there's something cool about it. Like, some of it is that familiarity that helps breed, you know, that audience and build that audience for the beer itself.
Yeah. And it's fun because we do have a variety and there's a variety of audiences that come in as well. So it's kind of something for everybody. I mean, and we've got tools from all of your different podcasts on many different things. And we just kind of combine techniques and ideas and create something that's kind of our own. But, you know, we're not saying that nobody else is doing it by any means. I mean, we're just using techniques that lots of people know.
Well, we're going to bring it full circle on this episode, and you can share back some of those things again out in the same way that you've listened and learned to those. Before we do that, Streamline Efficiency with Omega Yeast Diastole Knockout Series. The DKO series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diastole before it starts. The strains you know now better, available now for made-to-order pitchables at any volume. Contact Omega Yeast today at omegayeast.com. Also, ABS Commercial has been a full-service brewery outfitter for over 10 years. They're proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brews across the country, as well as equipment for distilling, cider making, wine making, and more. They know the ins and outs of the brewing and installation process and can design the perfect setup for you, whether you're just starting out or looking to expand. Contact them today at sales@abs-commercial.com to discuss your customized brewery needs. ABS Commercial, We are brewers. And if you're a brewer who's also interested in distilling, subscribe now to the Craft Spirits and Distilling Podcast, available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Hosted by Sydney Jones, head distiller for Few Spirits in Chicago, and Molly Troop, master distiller for Freeland Spirits in Portland, Oregon, this podcast explores the technical and creative processes behind great spirits through conversations with some of the leading distillers working today. It's everything you love about the Craft Beer and Brewing Podcast, but focused on distilling. Click on the link in the show notes and give it a listen. Well, Cameron, let's talk about cold IPA. Because we're drinking one right now, you brewed a few, you've got a big wrestling style belt now behind your bar because you won a recent IPA challenge here in Las Vegas with a cold IPA. And, and so it's something that you get into. Obviously, we're in Las Vegas. It's a desert. It's a very warm environment. People like crisp drinking beers, drink a lot of lager, just like, Austin, Texas or Phoenix, Arizona, hot places, man. Lager is such a natural thing for that. And so this cold IPA kind of scratches that hop itch while also providing a pretty light and clean, drinking experience for those folks. Talk to me about, as you approach cold IPA, both like pulling on source material, the old Kevin Davey, kind of foundation for it, but also making it your own, making a craft house iteration of it. Talk to me about how you approach that and maybe where'd you start in writing a recipe?
We were super excited to give it a shot after we listened to your podcasts and some other ones with him, and sounded like they could turn out really nice. So we actually, our first one we brewed here, we actually did a collaboration with Imbibe Brewery from up north in Nevada. Super good dudes, and it turned out pretty good. But we're always improving. But nowadays we've combined a few different techniques. I mean, we're doing 20-30% torrefied flaked maize for the grist. We don't have any sort of way to decoct or cereal mash or any of that, just a two vessel system. So just not have to worry about that. We just get the torrefied version and doing a little bit of that. We've actually started adding.
Why corn on that?
We really like the how it plays with the Pilsner malt, and just gives it a nice, I think, a better layer of body. We've tried rice as well. But we stuck with the corn. For us, it just seems like we like the mouthfeel of that a little bit better. That's really the only reason.
You said 30%?
20-30%. Yeah, okay. Typically. Well, we are always playing with the variables here and there and trying out different maltsters. And, but for instance, like the one we're drinking now, it would be with Brees, Synergy Pilsner, and then, I believe crisp torrefied flaked maize. But we did notice we were lacking some head retention on this particular style. So we tried using like a dextrin style malt and didn't really see a whole lot of improvement. So we've actually added in just like a small, like 2-3% of white wheat in there. Probably not enough to taste anything, but it has helped a little bit on that. I think there's just so many hops in this. It's a little tough for us. Maybe we could probably use some sort of extract on the other side too, but I think we're a small team and we're always really busy. So we're just trying to get as much as we can with as little as possible. I think you got to work with the tools that you're given as well. Like the owner's not going to let me go spend $500 to get this extract that I might use one time.
Sure.
So we got to be careful about how we spend. We're approaching it pretty simply. That's our basic crisp bill. We're running pretty dry on that. And then we're using a first.
You mentioned you also really enjoy the Gambrinus pills.
Yes. Yeah. That's kind of when we've landed on, like where we got the IPA Smackdown belt here. And, but we're always still trying some other ones that there's some of them are a little bit stronger in flavor and other ones just didn't really work at all for us.
Didn't work? And only obviously it's not like the malt would never work. It just didn't work in this cold IPA.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So our base Pilsner malt we use in a lot of our other beers, like our Saison and our Czech, that we tried that and it just ends up being a little diesely grassy character. And it may not be the malt in particular, but we have noticed that on that malt with ales as well. So if we did an ale with that Pilsner malt, we did notice the same character in that. So we're just kind of avoiding that malt for IPAs in particular. But
interesting. So it works well on the lager side because you want some of that character in it. And then on the IPA. It just adds too much on top of what you're already getting from hops.
I think so. Yeah. With these beers, we do approach the kettle a little bit like hazies. However, we do go with like a first order hopping typically. We'll try to get about 50 IBUs out of that. And then everything else we're actually throwing into a cool pool. So we'll chill that whirlpool at about 185.
50 IBUs out of your initial bittering charge.
Yep.
All right. Going big.
Well, when we chill that wort down, you know, during the whirlpool, we're not going to be getting as much of the bitterness character out of
right.
it. And we have noticed that when we do this style, if we don't get that really nice bittering charge, then it's just not bitter. It does tons of hop flavor and aroma, but there's just not the bitterness to match. And so we found that really has been helpful in getting sort of a bright character to the beer. And we've been using more like old school kind of bittering hops rather than some of the brighter, more interesting character hops. Because we're really just trying to get, we don't really care about the flavor of the bittering hops. Mm-hmm. We just want the bitterness. So we've done like German Magnum is probably our go-to on that.
Yeah.
Whereas like for more of our West Coast, we might use Columbus or something more American. But I think since we're packing in so much hops into the whirlpool, that doesn't really matter at the end of the day. We're not getting any of that earthy, like herbal character from that. By the way, we also have to play with the water a bit too. We're going for something bright and snappy. Really just the opposite, funny enough, of a hazy, really. We don't want that soft mouth feel. We want it to be crisp, you know, Pilsner-esque, I guess West Coast Pilsner is very popular right now. So kind of like that kind of vibe to the water profile. And then, of course, we're fermenting it with our... Sure.
What is it, you mentioned, you know, you don't have an RO system here, so you're having to work on, you know, pretty tightly on managing your water chemistry. And it's pretty easy for things to fall off if you're not, you know, especially with this hop forward style, if you're not really diligent about it. Talk to me about that process.
It's been an interesting juggle coming here for that because the water year is very hard. And it does change throughout the year a lot. I've heard they've got it pretty bad in San Diego with their water source. So I'm not going to complain too much. Like I've tracked this over the course of my time here, and I do tend to see the shifts in that profile happen at certain times of the year. So other than if my pH is off, you know, that's usually an indication that I should probably get it checked, but we're usually only getting it checked every 2 months right now. But that's just because we kind of have seen the history of it, and it has gone through the same shifts.
You know, year when to the year. Seasonal things are going to come.
Yeah. So we juggle that. We just use Ward Labs, quick shout out. I mean, they're super cheap and really reliable. So we could just get a sample, send it there, and get it back a couple of days later, and we're ready to make any adjustments if needed. But it's not too hard once you've got that kind of pattern set. You know, your mindset that water is like a critical part of the beer, and we should be taking just as much care about that as everything else.
Sure. So you do filter and clean things. Are you doing any pre-boil or any, you know, other kinds of strategies to decrease that hardness, or what's your typical adjustment to that water then look like?
So right now our system is fairly simple. I mean, we're just getting carbon filters replaced every quarter, I believe, and then there's a softener cartridge that's replaced.
Okay.
And then we just, I mean, all of our brewing water is held hot forever. Like, we don't have steam. It's just electrically heated. So everything is, let's just say the bottom of my hot liquor tank is really no fun to clean. I'll put it that way.
I bet. Cool. So you build this base for water, and you find that water impacts it. You know, we talked about the impact, flavor impact of malt. You know, then your bittering comes through Magnum in the front. Let's talk about the late edition hops. Yeah, where the rest of a lot of your flavor is coming from. Talk to me about your strategy now. You know, and maybe we'll talk about a couple of the different strategies. You know, maybe a more classic strategy that you may have employed for, you know, this belt winner over here, the IPA Smackdown, or then what you've done here with this incredibly modern approach to layering in both T90s and, you know, cryo or CGX, hops. In a way that, is meant to really show off the capability of these hops.
So, I don't see any reason to not use the blend of cryo and T90 anymore if we're doing this style. Like, it's so usually a one-off batch for us. We're only doing this as a seasonal item. It's not like I'm, you know, we're not feeding ourselves with this beer necessarily. So I think we can afford to spend a little more, and people are willing to spend a little more at the bar as well. And so are the accounts.
It's even better when the hop company gives you or sends the hops to you so that you can brew a showcase beer for them at CBC. That makes it a real easy question to answer.
Yeah. Well, we've done a couple different versions of this, iteration. So like the one over there that we've got the belt for, that was with the Gambrinus Pilsner. And then we're just using T90 Citra and Mosaic. With the splash of Eldorado, and then in the dry hop, we're using, again, Citra Mosaic, but then with cryo versions as well. And, you know, that I've heard a lot of this percentage, that percentage. I mean, honestly, we're just doing 50-50, and it seems to be great. We're getting just enough vegetal character from the T90 that it doesn't seem like too one note. And rather than work with semantics, I don't get to brew this all the time. Like, if I was brewing this every week, I mean, I might be changing the percentages, like, 1, 2, 3 here and there, but we just don't get that many opportunities. And this has been plenty good enough for me because it's my favorite go-to beer right now. And same with our customer base at our Henderson tap room. It's the number one seller.
So then why layer in, a CGX and a T90 on top of each other? Obviously, if you go more concentrated, you've got a 10-barrel brew house here. You know, maximizing yield is an important, piece of this equation. You don't want to be losing many more beer than you have to the production process. So there's a aesthetic and a creative decision that you're making along the way there.
Yeah. I think the main thing is, because we're taking that hazy approach where a lot of people are saying, well, 4 pounds per barrel, this. Well, I don't want to put 4 pounds per barrel in, but I can almost make it seem like I did if we just dry hop with these, right? So we're probably shooting more to close like 2.5 pounds per barrel, but we're getting this huge aroma from that. So again, we're not losing that yield on the cold side. Whereas in the kettle, we're still just using T90, but again, we're doing that cool pull technique. We're not using any cryo in the kettle currently.
Okay. Why not?
Just haven't tried it yet. To be honest.
That's fair. And then, how do you balance hops between the whirlpool and the dry hop, knowing what your target is for how strong you want that expression to be, and knowing that that you're going to be cool pulling there. How do you when you're thinking about that recipe, how do you divvy those up?
A little bit just comes from experience over the years of just constantly making new beers. But I think that I always try to make a connection somehow throughout the beer so that some of the hops you might taste early on in the beer you might still be able to taste in the final product. So, if we add it in early, I want maybe there to be some sort of connection to how it smells. I don't want any of those hops to be wasted, but I also don't want them to all be a wash either, because I've had many IPAs where it's generically hoppy, let's put it that way, and there's not really any particular expression of those hops that you can pinpoint. I think the key for me is not using any more than 3 or 4 hops varieties. If that seems to just come out with a generic-y tasting IPA for me. Now, whereas if you can focus on a few flavors and target when you're adding them, like for instance, that other cold IPA, not this one, but we did actually have a 5-minute addition in there. And that was just to kind of tidy things up in the mouthfeel department. Because I feel like if we're just using Whirlpool hops, and I've done this on a few West Coast IPAs, there's just something missing to the beer for me. You've just added in your bittering hops, and he didn't add anything. So there's not a whole lot of flavor component there, in my opinion. And that can be semantics, and you can argue one way or the other, but I think there needs to be some other hops in the boil at some point. Just you're adding in just a little bit of more layering of that character. And again, tying the whole thing together in a nice package versus it being just kind of disjointed where you just have the bittering and then it's all at the very end there.
It sounded like you almost, mentioned that there was something textural about that, that it's almost maybe not just purely a flavor thing, but also just, the way that the beer feels in your mouth.
Textural might not be the word, but I think it's just like a vegetal character that the hops, the C90 hops can bring, but I think that a lot of the concentrated hops don't. And we've actually seen that in our hop waters as well. Like if you try making hop water with concentrated products, a lot of time it's just missing that beer component. Like it just, it tastes like hops a little bit, but it smells like hops for sure. But there's just not that green character that I think really ties the IPA as an IPA, right? Or a hops flavor as a hop flavor. So, you know, when I was homebrewing a long time ago, obviously, so I was like, oh, first your bittering hops, then your flavor hops, then your aroma hops. But somehow in the last, 10, 15 years, the flavor part has kind of disappeared to the wayside. And I think that's okay for most consumers. Like most consumers didn't want that anyway. And modernizing IPAs is great. But I think we should still have some of that in there. So we're not talking about large additions here, but just little drops here and there that are going to kind of tie the whole package together. And that kind of helps just build structure on the beer where it's not so one note.
It's interesting to hear even from the, on the hazy IPA side, like Parrish, you know, pulling in classic sea hops in a, even in a hazy IPA in a way that you might not expect it. You know, and I've been hearing more and more of that. It's interesting to, you know, to hear more brewers pulling on things like, you know, Cascade, Chinook, Centennial, you know, and, some of these classic hops, not, you know, number one, because they also have flavors that can carry through pretty well, you know, especially if they're on the hot side. Number two, you know, because there's almost a little classic and, you know, association, I think, that, you know, a lot of us have with some of those flavors that we actually like, even if, you know, and in small doses in that modern context, it's like a little sample in a, you know, a new hip hop track that takes you back to, you know, 20 years ago. And you're like, oh man, I love that song. And the whole song isn't that, but you know, you just get a little clip in there and it's just, you know, it brings back good feelings.
That's a great way to put it. And that's kind of the vibe, like that's where we're going for really. Cause we want to make beer that we want to drink and also beer that everybody else wants to drink. It's not just for me. I like to pretend it isn't, but usually it is at the end of the day. I mean, if it's not a beer that I'm going to drink, that I'm just going to be mad about it the entire time it's on tap until it's gone. And then I'm never going to want to see it again, or we're going to have to go rework the entire recipe. You know, but after you paid for a label, it's like, well, you can't throw this in the dumpster. Now we got to like go through a whole reformulation. And then if it sucks again, then, you know, then you didn't learn anything, fortunately.
For sure, for sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about dry hopping. Before we do that, this episode is sponsored by Yakima Chief Hops as a global preferred supplier of NZ hops. Yakima Chief is the source for the pronounced bright and tropical aromas New Zealand hops are known for, adding a rush of exotic fruits and zesty citrus to your recipes. Used on their own or in conjunction with your favorite American varieties, NZ Hops brands are an excellent tool for exceptional brews. NZ Cryo is now available through Yakima Chief Hops. Learn more at yakimachief.com. Also, if you're opening or expanding a brewery, getting your building right is one of the most important things you'll ever do. The architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. With over a decade of experience designing breweries, the folks at OPA are here to serve as your trusted experts from start to finish with their full range of architectural services. Visit designopa.com to set up your no obligation introductory consultation today. All right. So we've talked about hot side and whirlpool hops. Let's talk about dry hopping. Anything to the way that you go about doing that? Here you are mixing T90s and cryo or concentrated hop products.
We're doing a little bit of everything, to be honest. A lot of times our old school approach is best for the common day consumer everybody knows, I think, that, you know, after 1.5 pounds per barrel, where it's just really diminishing returns after that and so forth and so forth. So, you know, we've tried all kinds of techniques to improve that aroma, but that just seems to be a hard and fast fact with T90. So, you know, we're trying to maximize those. I lean on what everybody else has done, really. And there's an old Master Brewers TQ article, I think it was with Great Notion and Sapwood Cellars, about best practice dry hopping techniques. And, you know, if you haven't looked at that, you're probably already doing it, but if you're not, you should be. Basically, we're just Are they using a hop doser?
We've got a great all-access video class with Scott Janish of Sapwood Cellars on where he goes into all of that using hops. For all-access subscribers to Craft Beer and Brewing, go to beerandbrewing.com.
We have a hop doser for a lot of our tanks. Mm-hmm. So that's best practice. We'll hook that up, purge that, put hops in, purge it again.
So gravity sits on top of the tank and drops down, purge. Okay.
It has its own safety concerns when you're just with the ladder. So it's not very lightweight. And most tanks, I'm sure you all know, are not flat on top. So it doesn't really leave itself to be easy to use with, if you're by yourself. So definitely a team effort if we're going to get that going. Unfortunately, that doesn't fit on all of our tanks that we have. So we try to line up the schedule to get those types of beers in those tanks. But when it doesn't happen, the best practice is always going to be, purging with CO2 as we're adding those hops at the same time. I'm sure everybody already does that as well. But there's additional tips. They have advice for rousing the hops multiple times. We found that really didn't improve flavor at 1.5 pounds per barrel at all. But when we went over 2 pounds per barrel, we did see a larger improvement with the rousing of the hops. So we're doing 30 PSI for 30 seconds, a couple of times post dry hop, and then make sure we dump those on time to try to avoid any vegetal notes. So,
but only with the heavier hop loads, not with the lighter ones.
Yeah, we didn't really see any improvement, and that could be just due to our tank geometry here. So, we'll put that as a tool in the tool belt for if I move somewhere else or get some different tanks that are maybe wider or more narrow. But I think everybody might have different experience, so it's worth trying out the best practices first and then seeing how that works in your brewery, because again, it's just going to be all dependent on just the little things like that.
Yeah, sure. What do you, in terms of time, temperature, pressure, what have you settled on to maximize that kind of dry hopping experience?
Usually, yeah, we'll wait till beer's terminal, we'll pass VDK, and then we'll proceed on the dry hop.
Only post-terminal dry hopping, okay.
Yeah, well, so we've done some other stuff, like on the hazies. If it's a hazy, we might do with like 2 or 3 Play-Doh remaining. But there's a lot there that we'll have to use the hop doser for that, because we're not going to put ourselves at risk of some kind of volcano or happening or anything like that. But typically, I've seen a lot of people lowering temperatures to avoid diacetyl, and I just put it in at the regular temperature, to be honest with you, whatever I fermented at. Not with the cold IPA, it's a little different. We will ramp up the temperature for that. We didn't even talk about the fermentation on that style, but
no, we should go back and talk about fermentation on that though.
So we'll do a little bit different on that, but typically like for a regular IPA, we'll pass VDK, we'll dry hop it, we'll spun the tank at that time. Whatever pressure we get, we'll keep. And that's basically free carbonation, so why would I not? We'll rouse it a few times and then dump the hops usually after 3 days, check VDK again, if we're good, then proceed on to crash. Otherwise, it might take a few more hours to kind of clean up, but typically with our pitch rates, we're seeing no issue at all with it cleaning up within 3 days. And any more than that, I tend to get more vegetal character that I don't really care for in the beer. Now, we might dry hop it again after we dump those hops. I'm not saying that, but that's going to be for something that's a little more pricey or special. But
sure.
We're really trying to jam as much in there as we can. But we haven't really done anything more than 4 pounds per barrel, and that's pretty rare that we do anything like that size. 2.5 seems to be a nice amount that everybody seems to like, and it's not overboard, and we're still making money at the end of the day. I think that's important for everybody, because people aren't going to come in and buy $10 pints forever. So
it is important to make that beer good and also profitable. Those things do have to go hand in hand. Let's talk about fermentation on cold IPA. You're not using 3470 in this one.
We are not, no. In fact, I don't really even use a German lager yeast here.
No?
At all. Yeah, we just use this Czech lager strain.
What Czech strain?
It's it's 2782 PC from Wojs, and it's a private collection strain from Staropramen Brewery in the Czech Republic, I believe. Kind of fell in love with this yeast on a whim. They were offering it for their private collection, and I was like, oh, that sounds pretty cool. So I ordered it, and I was like, wow, this performs really consistently, and it was actually easy to harvest this lager yeast, and that almost never happens. So I just kind of stuck with it, and then it's really easy to keep going. viability is always really good on it. We never have any issues. Fermentation line curves are always the same. It's pretty awesome. But when we got the cold IPA, we're like, well, I don't know if this yeast is going to work for this, but we're going to try it anyway. So we just fermented at, closer to 60 as the primary, and then we'll let it ramp up that 2 or 3 Plato left up to like 62 or 64. We're still kind of playing with the range we like at the end there. And it seems to be hop dependent. So we're going to dry hop it at that temperature again after we SVK. And some of them do tend to be a little more grassy. So we're still kind of playing around with maybe getting a little higher to avoid that on certain varieties. But we'll use like the Citra Mosaic combo. 62 is fine. It's not really grassy at all. It's great.
I love it that the hop variety can impact the dry hop temperature then for that.
Yeah, all the hops are very different. So, why wouldn't it? I mean, it's not a variable that I have like figured out completely yet, but we're definitely keeping an eye on those targets and saying if we continue to see issues with particular varieties and we don't like that flavor, then what happens if we dry hop that 2 degrees higher or 2 degrees less? And if that's because that might be the only point we're adding that hop in that beer. And we just take the hop away completely and swap it with something that's not going to give us, a character we don't want.
Yeah. So, what is it about this this yeast that you find really compelling? Obviously, it hits from a technical standpoint, it's consistent and you've got, viability and harvestability, all of those things, but flavor has to be a driving factor for you too. And it actually, contributes some additional character, both to your cold IPAs and to your lagers. How would you describe that?
I think it's just got a lot of variability in its, just characteristics. So I've noticed when we will do our dark lager and we'll ferment that nice and cold, we'll get hardly any yeast character at all. Whereas we ferment a little warmer, like with our color pills, it's going to be way more expressive. And depending on when we spun that tank, we can kind of collect some of that back into suspension a little bit. So we'll spun that beer pretty early to try to retain a little bit of the sulfuriness intentionally, but it's not overblown. And it does produce a pretty good amount of sulfur. So, when we're doing big batches, it does stink pretty heavily in the brewery early on in fermentation. But I don't know, it just seems there's a lot of variety in the character and always leaves us with a nice full-bodied lager. Again, we don't really have any way to do any decoction here. So I think giving us that full-bodied flavor just with that characteristic alone is very helpful, because a lot of times with the 3470, the beers just end up too dry for me, too watery, and there's just not enough residual character there like the beers you'd have actually in Europe. So that's just kind of how we're achieving that here, is with the yeast as one of those tools to kind of achieve that.
I, of course, have the little voice of Chris Loring from Notch in the back of my head, encouraging everyone to try yeast other than 3470. And you're singing a similar tune right here. It's fun to hear it. Is there anything else to the cold IPA process here? Then you finish dry hopping, carb it up.
After dry hop, we'll spun it, and then I think a lot of small breweries, they might be finding their beers at that point if they don't have a filter. I think we've perfected a technique to find the beer without opening the tank up again, which has been really helpful. We're able to shoot it up into the beer and then let it settle, and then we'll just move it to our bright tank. And that's been super cool to not have to blow off all those aromas that we just spent all that effort to collect, we have tried unit tanking these as well versus transferring them, but I haven't really seen any difference on that. I know I've heard some other brewers' techniques of, it's going to a competition. We're not going to move it out of this tank. It's from there to package and that's it. But we haven't really seen any difference once we transferred it. So there's not really anything special we're doing.
You give them any time to sit in condition or?
So we do. After we dry hop, we're doing a lot of dumps on these tanks as well. So we'll dry it off.
Shaves. You're shaving the cone.
It's just shaving the cone. Yeah. I like that term. We'll do one after.
Dumps is just such an ugly word, like shave.
I don't know. I like dumps. We'll do a shave and dump. after 3 days of dry hop. And then, you know, we'll at that point, we'll start lagering the beer. Maybe two days later, we'll do another shave and dump. Luckily, with this Czech strain, you know, we're able to harvest like no problem just before the dry hop. So we're able to take that yeast out of there and keep that thing going with like before any hops are introduced. That's right. Another reason I really don't like adding hops before terminal.
Sure.
I like to keep the yeast going, and when it's full of hops, it's kind of not as good. So we'll just we'll do that. We'll dump it again. We'll let it lager. Typically, like, you know, most of our regular West Coast, we might do, you have 4 or 5 days of crash time. So we're kind of in a rush to get things out most of the time. But we'll give that one at least 10 days probably. So we don't do like a full on lager with that. But I mean, you're drinking it right now and doesn't seem like it needed it. So
no, pretty fresh. And there's something about the brightness, like it's always a balance, especially with this, right? Finding that smoothness versus the brightness of the hop character. And, you know, there's a point where more conditioning is working against, you know, some of what you're trying to go for.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be more and more yeast and hops that continue to come out of suspension throughout that time. So, I mean, it is important to kind of keep an eye on your shaving. You got to get the stubble out of there, right? But that's why we don't like extended aging just for that reason alone in the tank. Like, if I can drink it fresh right now, I will. And that's kind of the same vibe with our Keller pills, too. I mean, like, it still tastes like a great Pilsner. Might be a little easy, but that's totally intentional in that beer. Whereas our Czech, the dark lager, that's a whole different ball game. You know, we'll do a full on lager on that. We're going to age that for a couple of weeks, you know, after the fact. But, you know, that's kind of, again, with back to that yeast, there's the variability in what you can achieve with that. And I've just been really happy with that. And, you know, there's tons of lager yeast out there that I've heard are really awesome, but I just haven't had the opportunity to try. There's a Zurich lager yeast that I've heard is pretty cool. I think that's what they use for Sammy Claus, I believe.
Hmm.
But that beer is no longer seen. So,
well, you got to make an Imperial Cold IPA then, I guess, and or a triple cold IPA.
It's on the books. We're gonna give it a shot. However, I haven't really enjoyed this particular yeast for that. Let's put it that way. I already did an Imperial Cold IPA with collab with Odyssey Beerworks last year for their 10th anniversary. And it turned out pretty nice, I think. It was called Snow Trooper, I believe. But yeah, I think the word cold really helps it sell in the desert. People say, oh, cold? Yep. Sign me up for that.
Take that, you argumentative IPL people. Putting cold in the name helps it sell in hot places and makes it all the more marketable. 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah. Well, I still like IPLs too, so I just... Nobody makes them because nobody bought them.
Fair enough. Well, we've been talking about cold IPA for a long time now. Cameron, what else do you love brewing? And is there another beer that you've been working on lately that you've been learning a lot about?
Well, we've been doing a lot of coffee beers as of the last like 3 years. They always seem to rate really high for us.
Hmm.
Light in body, like Schwarz beer kind of base, you know, Imperial stout barrel aged. Basically, if you put coffee in it, it seems like people in this town are jumping on it.
They like to stay up all night and they like to wake up early and get to the casino at 8 o'clock in the morning, which is an amazing thing to watch down here.
Yeah, we've done some cool coffee collabs as well. They're kind of an interesting technique that we have achieved with that. We've got a local bottle shop here. I encourage everybody to check them out during CBC, so shameless plug, but Corey's Fine Wine and Spirits, been a long supporters of the local beer scene.
KHOURYS.
That's correct. Yep. And this was their idea, but then they asked if I could do it, and the answer was probably. So we partner with 4 local coffee roasters to create a mix pack beer with the same base beer, but coffee individual from each of the roasters in those. So you get the 4-pack and each label's got the individual roaster and the color's a little bit different. But all of it is the same base beer. And we've done that project twice. The first time took forever. And the second time we had it down. So, but we were able to package off of all of those 4 in one day, while changing out the labels and getting it all put together. So it was pretty fun. Only took one fermenter to do all of that. So Kind of a cool technique, but we had to work with the roasters and like, I'm like, this is what the beer is going to taste like. And they, I want you to guys.
So, yeah.
To
so what are the parameters on that? Is this a dark base beer? Is this a pale base beer? And then you, I, you know, when you, if you're using one fermenter, then you're brewing one wort and fermenting one wort and then splitting out in the tanks for conditioning on coffee after that. Talk to me about your process on it.
Yeah. So we've done a few different ways of coffee and they all seem to work, to be honest. Like that, our easiest and most simple technique I heard from some podcasts, I think Pizza Port just threw the beans in. And it turns out great pretty much every time, but it didn't give us that flexibility here where we'd have to be tying up quite a few tanks to be able to accomplish that. Where we're just putting beans in. So by working with the roasters and telling them about what style we're brewing that time, I can kind of let them put their best foot forward. So I give them the details of the beer. So it might be a golden ale, Schwartz beer, you know, IPA, those kind of things. And, you know, kind of tell them what the base characteristics are. And then I ask them to usually bring me a cold brew concentrate that they make on their own. Or if they need me to do it, we can do it here. It's just going to be a lot more effort. And then basically we'll sample the base beer against that cold brew. We'll choose like a micro pipette and like determine a rate that we want. So we can figure out how many pounds we're going to add. And so those are just blended on the way to the bright tank. So set up an inline sort of blending station there. And then I had the canning line set up on the far side of the bright tank. So we just transfer and blend the coffee in and run the cans, then transfer the next part, blend it, run the next cans. It's all the same base beer going in the bright tank each time. It's only in there for, you know, an hour or two. So we're just not really worried about cleaning it between those cycles. But of course, at the end, we will full clean it.
Sure.
But, seemed to allow us to process all four of those in one day, which was kind of cool. Five barrels a pop, and then just change out the labels on the labeler. And well, of course, somebody has to assemble all those mixed packs, but the store graciously volunteered to come in and they helped assemble those. And it's cool. We usually do like a commemorative mug each time we do that. And mm-hmm. I think people have a lot of fun with it.
So you've changed up, have you changed up the base beer then between each ones of these runs?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's fun for the roasters. It gives them a little bit of a challenge, and they can be creative too. Some of them consumers are more excited about some of those varieties than others. So that's been kind of a weird thing. We don't do this all the time because it is kind of a layout of manpower, but it's really cool. A commemorative glass, people get nerdy about it, and you know, then they can buy each of the coffees from the roasters too, because they usually have them on display at the release. So. You can kind of have the exact roast that was in the beer, which was super fun.
What have you learned through that process in terms of, you know, coffees that you find express really well in beer, whether that's variety, whether that's the way it's roasted or whatnot?
Well, being that I'm not really a coffee drinker, but a coffee beer drinker, I don't know too much about all the different varieties of it. However, I found that if the roast is too dark, people don't seem to like it as much. Light, medium roast seems to be more approachable for most consumers. But also you learn a lot about consumer purchasing habits because they really don't like the words lager and coffee at the same time. That did not work out as well as the other ones for us. But that's all right. It still tasted good.
Coffee stout works. Coffee ale works. But coffee lager does not.
People didn't want to buy that one.
Huh.
So... that's all right, though. It's all about fun experimenting, and we've done a bunch of newer coffee varieties. You know, we did mixed coffee with some three different kinds of nuts for our anniversary beer last year, which was super fun. It's like a barrel-aged double oatmeal style with coffee, and then we added almond and pistachio and macadamia in there, and that was pretty cool. That'll be on tap probably at our barrel-aged Bacchanal Sunday, CBC Sunday, at our downtown location. Along with several other barrel-aged beers. So please come free up my kegs so I can use them for other beers. Thanks.
Barrel-aged Bacchanal. What's your personal project? You know, there's got to be a beer or two that take out an outsized amount of your brain space. Those beers that you make because you also love to drink them, and they're just that personal quest to constantly improve each time you brew it. Is there a beer like that that you've like put so much like personal love and attention into? I mean, obviously you're going to put that into all the beers you make, but You know, is there one in particular that sees an outsized amount of your brain space?
Yeah, I'm pretty much always thinking about drinking one beer, and that's a Scotch ale.
Really? To be honest.
We started brewing that at Odyssey a long time ago. Didn't sell to most consumers. They opened with that as one of the opening beers on tap and like try to keep it on as a regular beer, but people just didn't buy it, except for me. I drank way too much of that. And then they got a gold at World Beer Cup, I believe, for that. And then they stopped brewing it. So then when I got down here, I'm like, guess what's getting brewed again now? Yeah, and then we do put a little peat in there. You can hate on me all you want, but I like that character in my Scotch ale. And every year, we'll admit we've gone to every other year on that, but we'll do a barrel-aged version that comes out the opposite year. But yeah, I'm always thinking about drinking that one. And every year it's kind of fun because I'll try to change the maltsters, but I really don't want to. I don't think I will this time. But we have just regulars that come in. They're like so excited every time it comes out. I get people calling me, having me mail them that beer. You know, it's that's just one of those.
Scotch ale.
It's just one of those beers that's stronger. It's full body, but it's not too heavy. Like it's not heavy like an Imperial Stout would be. You know, it retains some drinkability, but it's very malt forward, and just it's a very approachable style. I think just from anybody, it is strong. But other than that, I think they're just a classic taste to that style. You don't see them enough. We're in the desert, so I never get to do that, except for I don't see anybody else in town doing it. And beers like that and Doppelbach, those are just, when I go to the store, that's, I want something that's malt forward, typically, and I just not finding it these days. So it's even more exciting when I find beers like that, because I'm like, oh yes, I'll take some Optimator or any of those classic beers when I see them, but I just don't see them often.
Just need to move to Montana. Scotch ale, Scottish ale, still really big up in Montana. It was amazing. Amazing to see all the breweries making this beer because that was what their audience wanted.
It's funny too, because they know my love for it here, the owners. And one year they purchased me a 1-foot by 1-foot parcel of land in Scotland to officially make me a lord.
Every few years we run some stories in the magazine around brewing Scottish ale, Scotch ale, and one of these years we're going to get it right and be right on the front end of the next trend, which will be an old trend, because all of this is cyclical and it will come back again eventually.
But it's the year of the lager, right? That's what they say every year.
It is now, but then folks will get tired of lager and we'll move on. We'll move back to malty beer. I'm sure it's going to happen. It'll have to happen because, it's craft beer. We get tired of everything eventually, right? Gotta keep things moving, even if the direction is moving back to an echoes of the past. All of those are kind of important trends, and we'll see them anyway. Let's zoom out for a minute. You've been engaged in a lot of experimentation and, dialing in beers. What's next on the horizon for Craft House? What do you hope to achieve over the next couple of years here with Craft House?
Well, I think we take a step back and like look at what we have done since I got here. And I think the goals were partner with UNLV to create a beer that's gives back a percentage to the hospitality college. And that took quite a few years, but we were able to finally accomplish that. And now it's one of our best-selling beers. And since we're all alumni that work here, it's super cool for us to be able to give back. And we had just yesterday, the beers course was here getting a tour and learning about beer, which wasn't something that was available when I was there. And so I think it's cool to have that opportunity and show them that there's a pathway in that if they want. And then the other big goal was to get CBC here. And I'll have to give credit where it's due to our owner, Wendy. She's done a lot of effort to work on getting that here. As much as people are mad about it, like we do have a pretty good craft beer scene here. So I hope everybody can come out and check everything out.
Well, we're going to get people stoked on coming to CBC and experiencing beer here in Las Vegas. What are your top beer recs when people are in town? Obviously, they can come visit you either down in the brewery here in Henderson or the Craft House tap room in the Arts District, which is just kind of north of the main strip area, north of where the Venetian and CBC is. What are some of the other must hits for beer here in Las Vegas?
We already mentioned Corey's. They're amazing. They've been there since I was at college, always supporting the beer scene. They have local beers on tap. I'm sure they'll have CBC events and food trucks. And that's one of the few places we can actually take kids in this town. They have a patio that you can take your kids to, and they can just hang out in food trucks. But that's kind of an interesting thing about this town. You can't, if you're a family person, there's not as many opportunities to get out. But 595 Craft Kitchen is very good. They're on the southwest side of town, but they also sort of have a mini kitchen and Abel Baker's great. Just everything in the Arts District is really good. I think a lot of people might not know about like Hop Nuts Brewery. They're pretty close to where Craft House is in the Arts District, and their brewer is doing some really good stuff. He used to work at Gordon Biershear. Definitely knows what he's doing, and they had some really nice IPAs when I was over there last. LV Brew Co. as well. They'll have a brand new spot in the Arts District. I don't know if they're brewing there, or I don't know a lot of details about it, but I know that their brewers, they can make some really good stuff. So I definitely recommend checking them out, and they're going to be just around the corner from Craft House as well, or all the other breweries down there. Silver Stamp, I'm sure everybody already knows about. They'll be packed. Let's put it that way. Yes. They're going to be packed. Yeah, everywhere will be, but it'll be fun. We're going to have a good time. We're working on some things with the city to make it kind of a, hopefully a memorable experience for everybody that's here. And hopefully everything works out great. We're also, just throw it out there, but we'll have a promotion available through ride shares from the Venetian. If you are coming, there'll be a QR code to get a discount to take Uber or Lyft to the Arts District, to the breweries up north, or to the breweries in Henderson. They're kind of geo-locked, so if you're not going to those places, you won't get that discount with that code, but that should help everybody, just encourage them to get off of the strip and come see where the actual locals are.
That is awesome, and I think that's a great place to bring this to a close. Choose G&D Chillers on your next expansion or brewery startup and receive one free year of remote control and monitoring. Schedule a time now to meet with ProBrew at CBC, booth 1783. Old Orchard is the go-to source for fruit-forward ingredients for some of the biggest names in the craft brewing landscape. Omega Yeast Diastole Knockout Series is comprised of 8 familiar yeast strains engineered to knock out the formation of diastole before it starts. ABS Commercial are proud to offer brewhouses, tanks, keg washers, and preventative maintenance parts to brewers across the country. If you're a distiller or curious about it, check out our Craft Spirits and Distilling podcast as the global preferred supplier of New Zealand hops. Yakima Chief is your source for great NZ hops, now available in cryo. And the architects at OPA Design Studio are your partners in developing the unique design you need. If you've enjoyed this podcast, go to beerandbrewing.com. Click on the subscribe button if you are not a subscriber already. If you already are a subscriber, consider subscribing at that all access tier and access some of the great video classes that we produce, as well as industry folks. Check out the industry all access subscription, which bundles all of the great stuff that we produce, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, Brewing Industry Guide, and also Craft Spirits and Distilling, all in one industry-focused subscription. Cameron, if people want to learn more about Craft House, where do they find you all, both in real life and out there on the internets?
So crafthousebrewery.com, H-A-U-S, very important to note. And we do have our location in the Arts District on California Street, as well as the brewery location in the Henderson Booze District, both here in Nevada.
The Henderson Booze District. That sounds super official.
Well, we got a distillery right behind me right now, and there's a winery on my left and another brewery on my right and a meadery on my right. So come on down. You can just spend a whole day right here.
Fantastic. Well, it's been great talking with you about brewing. Yeah, I can't wait to be back here. In fact, this will air the week before. So everyone rolling into CBC will get to listen to this right as they travel in and fly in for CBC. So welcome to Las Vegas, everybody, and get out there and enjoy some great beer. Cheers.
Cheers. Look forward to seeing everybody.
This podcast has been brought to you by Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine, for those who love to make and drink great beer. To learn more or to subscribe, visit beerandbrewing.com or find us on social media at Craft Beer Brew.